All right, so we spent the last few shiurim that are on this topic talking about the theory of halachic change, which is how a Sanhedrin is able to change things, what kind of Sanhedrin is required, which would seem to have left us at a dead end, since we don't have a Sanhedrin, we don't have a, what you want to call, a minyan acher latiro, and we regard the Talmud Bavli as a davar shebe minyan, even if it is technically not. Technically, there was no Sanhedrin, they didn't have smicha, there was no formal gathering. Nonetheless, the practice seems to have been to accept the Talmud Bavli as a davar shebe minyan. So the question is, where does that leave us? The answer would be, well, we really can't change anything that's found in the Gemara. Theoretically, we should be able to change things that are found later. And that, on some level, is usually the starting point in the discussion. But, obviously, whenever you make this observation, the questions start coming out of the woodwork, but what about this that we don't do? What about that that we don't do? What about the other thing? And so on. And so, obviously, halacha has not been totally unchanging. And there are, it seems to me, any number of areas in halacha where it's obvious we don't do what the Gemara prescribes. And I think that one can actually attempt to classify the various kinds of changes fitting into certain categories, for the most part, which don't violate the rules of davar shebe minyan, sarach minyan achar lahatira. Now, there are a lot of sort of little exceptions, if I might call them, in that they don't really actually, they're not in any way a violation of the rule. They're sort of just a failure to perceive what is actually going on. But I think that in there are places, let me say it this way. I had a young man who came to speak to me yesterday to talk about what he should do with his summer, how he should spend it learning, and how he should divide his time up, and so on. And he asked me about learning halacha. And I said, the truth is, you're at the stage of your life, it's not as important. But if you really want to do a little bit of halacha, you should do the Aruch HaShulchan. He asked me, should I do Mishneh Berurah? I said, do Aruch HaShulchan. Now, Aruch HaShulchan, for those of you familiar with the style, it's much more useful, but it's much harder to read. You know, the Mishneh Berurah basically is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, a note here, a note there, a note there. If you figure out which sif in the Shulchan Aruch is sort of relevant to your case, you get the Mishneh Berurah's brief comments on it, and it's very easy to use in that regard. The Aruch HaShulchan, however, took a totally different approach. When the Aruch HaShulchan begins a siman in the Shulchan Aruch, and it's patterned upon the Shulchan Aruch, but there's no text of the Shulchan Aruch, but he begins by sort of presenting an introduction. You know, if we've seen the Beis Yosef already, which is really the core of the Shulchan Aruch, so he kind of summarizes pieces and summarizes sheet this, and he might quote a Gemara and explain sort of the foundation, and then he goes in, he'll quote the Mechaber, and he'll quote the Ramah, and he'll quote the Achronim later. But that's one thing feature that distinguishes the Aruch HaShulchan that makes it more difficult to use in the Mishneh Berurah. But there's another major distinguishing feature between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishneh Berurah, and they're roughly contemporaries. The Aruch HaShulchan is actually a little bit older, but the Aruch HaShulchan was not, I don't know if it was a question of, probably a question of funding, was published in dribs and drabs over time. It wasn't fully published in his lifetime. His daughter, in the mid, early, you know, I would say in the in-between war period and maybe even into the World War II period, was still publishing parts of the Aruch HaShulchan. The Mishneh Berurah was, I think, published much more in one fell swoop. So the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein, was actually older than the Mishneh Berurah, but he actually saw the Mishneh Berurah. There are a few places where he quotes it to argue on it, and I think in many ways you can understand certain aspects of the Aruch HaShulchan are a two-handed rejection of the Mishneh Berurah's entire approach. The Mishneh Berurah's approach, often in halacha, is to line up the shitas, the achronim, and yirei elokim yetzeis kulam, to try to be machmir for all of the shitas. That is certainly not the classic position in psak halacha throughout history. That's never the way poskim work, that's never the way Klal Yisrael work. The Aruch HaShulchan's approach is actually much closer to sort of classic psak, which is the Aruch HaShulchan will go to the mat almost always to defend minhag. And even if it seems that the minhag of the community is different than what the svarim say, it doesn't matter. Somehow you have to figure out why that it's okay. That is really certainly historically the norm in Ashkenaz, starting with the Baalei HaTosfos. We've seen this enough already, and onward. That is, if that it is established communal practice, however you figure out what's called established communal practice as opposed to what is deviance, so then you will figure out why it actually is okay. If you want to borrow, you know, Professor Jacob Katz's metaphor for the Baalei HaTosfos, communal practice, it was another text that had to be resolved against the text of the Gemara. That continued in many ways to sort of be the very traditional approach. Even, I don't know if I've mentioned this, I must have mentioned this, the Ramah in his introduction to the Darkei Moshe says that when he was a young Rav in Krakow, the Darkei Moshe is his commentary on Matur, like the Beis Yosef, and later eventually becomes the Rama on the Shulchan Aruch. So the Rama says when he was a young Rav in Krakow, he wanted the Paskin, you know, halacha, like going back to the Tosfos and the early Rishonim of Ashkenaz. Usually when we learn in the Beis Medrash, when we learn Gemara, we think of sort of the early Rishonim, and for good reason, sort of the powerhouses. And that certainly is the world of the Beis Yosef. When the Beis Yosef lays out his scheme of how he Paskins halacha, he says, when the big three Rishonim, the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush, you know, all weigh in on a matter, I'm going to follow the majority, which of course the Rama says is ridiculous because you stack the odds against the Ashkenazim. You have the Rambam and the Rif, who almost never differ, but that was the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef says the earlier the Rishon and the more prominent the Rishon, the greater authority has, and I'm more likely to follow that. So the Rama seemingly wanted to adopt, he says, I wanted to sort of take this approach, and the Balei Tosfos and the Rush, who are the earlier Rishonim and Ashkenaz, are going to be sort of the dominant ones. And his colleagues hit him over the head and said, sorry, we don't pass Kanalacha that way. You have to look at the later Sfarim, the Sfarim that pretty much almost nobody today opens up, because they're not commentaries on the Gemara, they're not major figures in people's minds, they probably were in their own generation's minds, and they get quoted in the Rama, all these funny shitos, more often the Chumra, but sometimes crazy kulas, that the Rama cites, whether it's from the Maharil, or the Sha'arei Dura, or the Mahariv, you know, mostly late 14th, 15th century works, you know, in the century before the Rama. That's what his colleague said, that's the way we pass Kanalacha, because we always follow Basrai, we always follow the later authorities, which is a rule the Gemara certainly presents. Hilchosik HaBasroi. So that's why the Rif said, we paskin like the Bavli against the Yerushalmi. And that really is sort of the classic method of Psak, right? It doesn't matter what the Noda Behuda said, it matters much more what Rav Moshe Feinstein said, because he was a contemporary. And so the Aruch HaShulchan's pattern in his day, and it's only a century ago, was in fact, almost always, he would defend what the Minhag Yisrael is. And whatever the area was, one of the notable exceptions, interestingly enough, but I think it's precisely because it was a change in his lifetime, was the question of women not covering their hair. In Lithuania and other parts of Poland, it became fairly common in the late 19th, early 20th century, married women stopped covering their hair. The Aruch HaShulchan, like Rav Moshe later, both accepted. They don't accept the not covering of the hair. The Aruch HaShulchan says Bavon Osein Harabim, but he does say that it doesn't constitute an erva for brachos and kriyashma anymore. In other words, it doesn't matter if you have a married woman and her hair is uncovered and you want to daven and you want to say kriyashma brachos, it's not an issue at all because it's not an erva anymore, because it's not erotic anymore. Even though he clearly assumes that it's not proper. But that was a practice that really was not universal, and it certainly wasn't in his generation. It was something that was really changing before their eyes, and he is protesting partially against it. But when you go back to what I would call Minhag Vasikin, when it's already a long-established practice. Again, he doesn't always know how long-established, but if his perception is such, then it has to be, then you actually have to sort of defend it. So in that regard, on some level, I say that the Bavli is the binding authority, but really what the binding authority is widespread communal practice. And we'll see, when we get to the end of this, end of these makoros, that when there is a conflict between the Bavli and broad-spread communal practice, it may be that broad-spread communal practice wins. We have to talk about that. But the first thing I want to look at in terms of the sources, and I've laid out sort of, I would say, four different, I didn't break them down with Roman numerals, but sort of four, here I think three or four different categories of how halacha changes. Only the last one is what I would call really where we're locking horns with the Talmud Bavli, but the first three are really not. The first one I presented here is Rav Moshe's tshuva, one of his several tshuvas on Chalav Yisrael. And the Gemara says that, and we saw the Mishnah already, we haven't really done this much of all the sugya yet, there's more to do, that Chalav Shechalav Ogoi, the Ein Yisrael Ro'eu, if there's milk that a non-Jew milked from a cow, but a Jew did not see him, so the halacha is that you can't drink the milk. We're afraid that maybe there's non-kosher milk mixed in. Now, the Gemara does say, we haven't seen this yet, that if, let's say that there's a pen of animals, and in the pen there are only kosher animals, so if you, even if you're not watching the guy when he milks the animal, if you see, let's say you see him walk in with an empty bucket, and you are sitting right outside the pen, then there's no way for him to. And let's assume then you don't have to worry. It's also true even if the guy could. There's another exit to the pen, but you're sitting near the entrance, and at any moment you could stand up, and watch what the guy is doing. And let's say the guy, he's going. He says, I'll bring you some milk from a cow. Even if you don't see him milking the cow, if he knows that at any moment you could stand up and see him, so he is not, the halacha assumes, he is not going to milk a non-kosher animal because he's afraid of getting caught. The principle the Gemara calls mirtas. He literally means he trembles. He's afraid of being caught. So people say, well, how is it that we drink Chalav Yisrael? As a historical note, I have a strong suspicion, but I don't know this for sure, that Ramosha came to America. Jews in America, I suspect, even from Jews, were drinking milk, commercial milk, before Ramosha got to America. And I have a suspicion that on some extent they probably weren't even asking the Shaila. Because on some level, they weren't experts in halacha, but everybody knew this was cow's milk because pretty much nobody in America, I mean, they're probably still today, there's probably virtually nobody who has a non-kosher animal milk because it's not, very few animals can actually be milked that are not kosher. There aren't so many, even camels, there aren't so many camels in the United States. There were camels once upon a time, I think they're extinct. And now they only live in zoos. So you know that the milk is kosher. You know it's the milk from a kosher animal, right? But, so I don't think it's that everybody was being machmir and not drinking milk, and then Ramosha got to America and somebody asked him the shaila and said, oh, Ramosha's clearly permitting the drinking of milk. Now remember also that there's a massive change from Europe to America, because in Europe, at least, I don't know about in the cities, but I think about, you know, what I hear from my father about his parents' experience in Hungary and the shtetl. So your milk came from a cow, not from a carton. And therefore, Chalav Yisrael was a very, very living din. However, when Jews moved to America, it might have been true in the cities in Europe, I don't know, so your milk did not come, it came from a cow, but you did not get your milk from a cow. You know, you got your milk from someone who was a distributor. It was commercially produced milk oil in Ramosha's just so charming way of translating, the way Ramosha transliterates, he doesn't translate a companies, right? The companies, that could be somebody's own dissertation of Ramosha's transliteration of words. It's sometimes maddening until you realize, this is when it's obvious that it's not a Hebrew word, but sometimes you can't figure out Ramosha's actually using a transliteration of an English word. Dishwasher is one of my favorites.
So edition that has the English translation.
What's that?
Edition of Igros Moshe that has the English words.
So Ramosha here is faced with a shaila, and he says it's not an issue. He writes, we'll read just a little bit of the tshuva. He says, "Uvdvar haChalav shel haKompanis b'Medina Seinu asher yesh pikuach haMemshala. There is government supervision. V'Miyarav uChalav abheim achalei beheim atmeya. If they mix in unkosher milk, yeAnshu, they will be punished. V'Gam yaskiras es shalahem, and they'll shut down their business." So Ramosha was challenged later, and people said to him, "It's not really true. They're not going to shut down their business." Point is that they might be fined, whatever else. So shalachin vaday mirtasi melaarev. They are afraid to mix in. Yesh tam gadol lahatir af belo shitas haprichadash. Now I don't know. I can't find this prichadash. It's not. I don't know what Moshe is talking about. He makes reference to it at the end of a previous tshuva. So I have no idea what this prichadash is. I can't find it. But he says you don't have to rely upon the prichadash. Mishum de ikar. The primary point is the yedia berura hu kari yamamish. It's clear from the Gemara, and he doesn't spell this part out here, from the Gemara, you don't actually need to see the milking. You simply need to have yediyah. That, and it's clear. But the question is, what kind of yediyah? In the Gemara's case in Avodah Zarah, it might have been a case where it's essentially impossible for the guy to substitute other milk. But Moshe says here, he says, sometimes in what we call, he's going to say in Anan Sadeh, simply that we know, even though we didn't see it, is sufficient in many areas of halacha. And he says, "Gedola mizeh isa betosos yivamos daf memhei b'shem yesh mefarshim gam ledin re'iyas based on the tfilas ger ayin shan." This is an unbelievable tosos. It's not one that I think that I'm not sure that this is the position we accept, but the Gemara wants to say that the Gemara talks about certain cases where you just assume that a person must have converted, and the question is, where is the tefillah? And the Gemara says, Milo Tava Lakerio, he must have certainly once gone to the mikvah for his Tumas Keri. If it's a woman, she must have gone once to the mikvah for Nida. And the question, of course, is, what good does it do if the tefillah wasn't in front of a beis din? So one of the answers Tosfos that he quotes is that there's an Anan Sadeh, that the person obviously must have gone to the mikvah. So the idea that sometimes an umdana, or what we call an Anan Sadeh, which means literally we are witnesses, is considered knowledge. So Ramosha says that's sufficient here as well. And he goes on to talk about some very interesting cases. Incidentally, one of the cases that touches upon a very important contemporary issue which is the question of, he doesn't relate it to that, of civil marriage and whether it's recognized halachically. One of the linchpins of civil marriage, one of the arguments for why civil marriage, a common law marriage, should be recognized halachically, which Baruch Hashem, due to Moshe, we don't, which saves us a lot of problems. But is that the Mishnah has the following case. If you have a man and a woman who were married, and they already have cohabited, and now they get divorced, and then they have yichud, the halacha is they require another get. Why? Because there's an anan sadeh that A, that the yichud led to bia, because they're comfortable around one another. And there's also another anan sadeh, another umdana, which is ein adam osa bilas o bilas nos. That a person faced with the opportunity of having a having an act of sexual intimacy, either be znus, an act of marriage, or in the context of marriage, people would prefer doing the context of marriage. I'm not sure that umdana is true anymore today. I'll stipulate that. I don't believe that all chazakos are non-changing, but in the context of the Gemara, so you have two principles there. Number one, that chazaka in adam osa bi'ilas o bi'ilas nos. Number two, you're assuming that bi'ah took place even though you only saw yichud, and that's enough to constitute a Vaday Kiddushin. And if the woman, how do I know that it's a Vaday Kiddushin? Because if the woman then turned around and accepted Kiddushin from another man, we wouldn't require a get from the second man. She's Vaday Mikudeshes to our first husband, remarried and so on. So there's an area in Halacha where you do rely upon two Umdanas, two Anan Sadeis, and it constitutes Yediyah Berur, it constitutes absolute knowledge. So Ramosha says that basically, in this case, all that's required by Chol of Yisrael, and it's clear from the Gemara itself, was as a Yediyah Berurah, and we have Yediyah Berurah in this case, because how does the Gemara establish Yediyah Berurah in cases, you know, clear knowledge where you don't see the milking, with an ansadeh of mirtas, that the guy is afraid he's going to get caught. And so Ramosha says here, in subsequent shuvas, he clarifies that even if they're not going to shut the business down, firstly for repeat violations, they might, and in addition, there's nothing in it anyway for the guy to substitute. So since there is a downside, he could get caught, he could be fined, even if it's not a big fine, therefore an ansadeh that he's scared of that, because balancing that, look, you know, if you take you could take many years halacha, you know, Chas v'shalom, when a people have an affair, right? So there is a chazak of mirtas there. People are all afraid of getting caught, but obviously in their minds, the benefits of whatever they benefit outweighs the concern of mirtas. So it's always a balancing act. How afraid are you of getting caught, and what are the consequences, and what are the benefits on the other side? So Ramosha says basically what?
Upside versus downside.
So the Ramosha says there's nothing in it for the guy to substitute milk in the first place, and since we know there is a downside to doing so, that constitutes Yediyah Berurah.
It specifically talks about companies. I will tell you, 75 years ago, plain milk was used in Sifted Teresh Yerushalayim. I drank it.
Okay.
It was a Talmud there.
And when you say plain milk, what does that mean?
Borden's.
I understand. I understand.
Company milk.
Listen, there is this legendary story about Ramosha, which is almost certainly not true. I think it's in the Art School biography that Ramosha once had drank chal that wasn't chal Yisrael, and then what?
Then it's surely not true.
Well, I understand. and he threw it up. Now, the reason why the story is ridiculous, A, is because, number one, it's ridiculous because nobody would have done that. Secondly, more importantly, and this is the part that I like better because of the silliness of people, it accomplishes nothing. If you eat tray food and you throw it up, you still get malchus. It makes absolutely no difference. There's a Gemara in Chulin that has a shaila. What happens? They want to know whether or not the prohibition, the shear is kizayis. So they want to know whether it's hanas meyav, it's the benefit in the stomach, or hanas grono, or the throat. What's the nafgamina? Nafgamina is not if you throw the food up after you eat it. It's what if you eat half a kizayis and then you immediately throw it up and eat it again. So they ask the shot within kizayis de achilas pras. So if it's hanas grown or hanas meyav, but it's clear once a kizayis reaches the stomach, it doesn't matter how long you leave it there, said you violated the isser, you get malchus. So even from a litvox perspective, it's a ridiculous story. Okay. So anyway, but one interesting note about this, Ramosha himself says this befeirish in one of the tshuvas. And I actually, this came up. You know, someone, a cousin of my wife who lives in Atlanta, say he likes to make his own mozzarella cheese. So mozzarella cheese is apparently much better made. So the rennet, you can get whatever rennet you buy, because rennet, you know, if it's not animal rennet, so it's not a problem. You just buy it at the... It's not a Gvina Sakum problem. The question, however, apparently to make the cheese, it's much better to make it with unpasteurized milk. But can't really buy unpasteurized milk in the store. So therefore, what did he do? He wanted to drive to a farm, you know, 30 miles north of Atlanta, and have the farmer give him milk. So he asked the shayla of a rav in Atlanta, and the rav said, the rent, it's not a problem. That may not require any hashgacha. However, the milk is a problem, because that's really chalav akum. Because in that case, it's not commercially regulated, and therefore, that doesn't fall under the rubric of chalav stan that Rav Moshe defines, and that you would have to see the guy. You bring in the bucket, or make sure the bucket is clean, and then he could give you your milk. But to do that without you actually seeing the milk, or without some type of, you know...
Some of the same things apply. The fact that the guy's saying that it's cow's milk, what would his incentive be?
So here's the important point, I think, that has to be established. It's not enough that there's no incentive for the guy to do so. There has to be a downside, some type of downside.
That's the reputation. Well, if you're buying from a guy...
Some balabas goes to a farm. How many people come? He probably sells the overwhelming majority of his milk to a company because he played a game on some Orthodox Jew came from Atlanta, right. And... That's not going to have any impact upon his business. So I think that there's sort of a neutral. I agree with you. Of course, he's
not today. By the way, that argument is wrong, right? So today you get on the internet, you write, I went to buy cow's milk from this guy, and you put cow milk in there, right?
Especially
in the artisanal food world, right, where these things are very important to make sure that what you say is in the thing is what's in the thing, right? So non-pasteurized milk is an artisanal dairy product today.
Yes, but it may be that people who deliver it in certain cases, they have a reputation to preserve. Here he doesn't. Again, I'm not arguing with you whether I think, of course he's not going to. He probably doesn't have a camel, right? I mean, that's pretty much a given. Right? I know near Camp Stone there are llamas, actually. There's a llama farmer like a mile from camp. But and they may even keep one in the refed. But I'm sure the guy has no camels anywhere near. I wouldn't want to try milking one of those llamas, I'll tell you that. They can be a little unpleasant at times. However, the point is that Rav Moshe here did not say that the Gemara's din doesn't apply. Rav Moshe basically said that following the parameters of the Gemara, the principle, the chazaka of mirtas, under certain circumstances, by commercially produced milk, the chazaka of mirtas is still present in the same way that it would have been in very specific circumstances at the time of the Gemara, and therefore Rav Moshe said that it's not a problem. And it's important to stress that for Rav Moshe, chalav of the companies is chalav Yisrael. We call it chalav stam, but it's not that Rav Moshe says you don't need chalav Yisrael. He says it is chalav Yisrael, because just as the Jews sitting outside the pen were any moment he can pop his head up, and the guy is milking the animals, and that's called Chalav Yisrael. And the same thing is true of the Chalav of the companies. Yeah.
So when you buy milk with a hechsher, what is that? What exactly has been lost?
I think the answer is nothing. I have no idea. When it comes to Pesach, at least they'll certify that the additives, didn't have whatever chametz problem. When the OU puts its stamp on milk, if it doesn't say Chalav Yisrael, I haven't a clue.
So then you can just buy milk without a hasher.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what we just said.
Yeah. That's the point. No, but he's asking. We said you can buy non-chalav Yisrael milk, but he's saying, what would the purpose of hasher be on the milk? I haven't a clue.
What's the purpose of hasher on water?
So I'll tell you. I'm not here to defend the carrier towards the OU, but they will tell you that companies. They'll tell companies that who want it, but companies want it because for consumers they perceive not even kosher consumers, but like kosher food or something. So they'll say openly. They say they claim it. They'll come as openly. You don't need a certification. The companies want it. They probably charge them pennies. What's that?
It puts a question on water for people who are uninformed.
Listen,
that's what happened.
I hear that side, but if the company is coming to you and saying, we really want, you could refuse, but it's a complicated calculation that you want to make with the companies. You tell them, you don't want, but they say they really want it, and so you decide, how much do you want to accommodate them because you want them for their business.
Yes, at another time we can discuss the halachic ramifications of selling people things they don't need.
Well, if they know they don't...
Clearly, water company does not need a hashgacha, even if they want it.
Maybe they're certifying the no copepods in the water. Right. I do know of a story. I will not say what the hashgacha was, but Rosh Yeshiva at YU many years ago, his son told me that on Pesach he was machmid to get the seltzer without the hashgacha. The person was he didn't trust the hashgacha of that person, so it was better to have the seltzer without any hashgacha than the seltzer with that hashgacha. So the answer is milk does not require, you know, milk, commercially sold milk in this country, it does not require an OU.
So how come people only buy challah
this round? So if you want to say you don't accept Ramosha's kula, that's a different story. But once you're buying non-Chalav Yisrael milk, the presence of a hashgacha, and as far as I know, is meaningless. Except for the Pesach, if you're concerned about the editors or something like that. And even there, you buy, you know, that's a separate discussion, you buy it before Pesach and it's batel. Mm-hmm.
But if you were, let's say, not be in the United States, would it be different?
It might depend on, it would be a question of applying the very same mitzvahs that you have here.
Because you're in another industrialized country.
Right. If you're in, I don't know what, you have to find it. In Great Britain, if the rules are also that milk has to be, you know, cow's milk or something like that, so then it's probably the same, it would apply there as well. But I don't know, you know, I don't know what the mitzvahs is there.
It's almost impossible to find hashgachas in Great Britain.
Okay, I mean, but it may very well be. It may be that the milk is the same status as it is here. I mean, I have a suspicion that outside of a few societies, there's probably very few places where people have non-kosher milk. Anyway, but it's just a question of, you know, of knowing what the realia is. All right, so that is one type where I would say that the realia has changed, but it's the very same halacha that's being applied. You just have to know how to apply the halacha in one circumstance as opposed to the other. Now to the second case. And one might sort of, one can take this category narrowly or broadly. The background to the story is the following. There are a couple of pieces of background. If a man dies without children, and he has a brother, so his wife typically requires yibum or chalitza. Okay, we don't do yibum anymore today, so we do chalitza. Now, if his wife dies, when he dies, at the moment he dies, his wife, he has a living child, so, and then the child dies subsequently. You get great cases in the Mishnah of what happens if a house collapses on a man and his son, and you don't know who died first. Right? And depending on who died first will determine whether or not the mother requires chalitza or not. So let's say you have a case where a man dies and then his son dies, or child dies, son or daughter dies, no chalitza. If there's no chalitza required or yibum required at the time of his death, she's free and it doesn't come back. What happens if he leaves his wife pregnant when he dies? So at that point, the answer is it all depends on what happens. If she gives birth to a living, healthy child, then there is no requirement to yibum or chalitza, that he left zera behind. If, however, she miscarries or she gives birth to a child that cannot survive, so then he has no zera and she requires yibum or chalitza. So al pidin, when the child is born, once the child is alive and breathing, you don't require yibum or chalitza. There will be not allowed to do yibum either. However, if the child dies within 30 days, there is a chumrah because maybe the child was not a bar kayama, maybe he wasn't actually a full-fledged child, and maybe he was a preemie, and therefore he was destined to die, and therefore she requires yibum chalitza. Now, the Gemara, and we've talked about this before, has a notion that there are two tracks on which babies are incubated. I think it's the best term I can use. 7 months and 9 months. Now, the Gemara talks about the concept of a preemie as a ben shmona, an eight-month baby, a baby born in the eighth month, or I would say maybe not nine complete months. And in that discussion, the Gemara says that it's possible that an eight-month baby was a seven-month baby that incubated a little longer, but that's not a problem. But the concern is that it's a nine-month baby that came out. Now, in that discussion, so forget that was not Chazal science alone, that was their contemporary science as well. Now, in that discussion, the Gemara says that even though some say that a seven-month baby can be born to a partial month, to mikutain, yoledes l'shiva, yoledes l'mikutain, and she might give birth after 6.5 months, and yoledes l'tisha, eino yoledes l'mikutain. If you give birth to a nine-month baby, full 9 months. So the Mechaber writes here, the following. Misha meis, the second source. V'hiniach ishton uberes. He dies and leaves his wife pregnant. Im hi pila, if she miscarries, arezo tisyabin. She requires yibum or chalitza. The imyolda, she gave birth. The yotza havlad chay lavir olam. The child came out alive. Afilu meis b'shar shenolad. Harei ima peturim en chalitza menibim. Even if he dies a moment after he's born, then there's no chalitza or yibam because rove children born are bar kayama. They're survivable. Avol midivrei sofrim ad sheivada bevadai shekalalo chadasha v'nolad l'tisha chadashim gemurim. Midrabanan, in order to pater her with this child who died before 30 days, you have to know the child was born to a full 9 months of gestation. The Ramah comes along and says the following: Yeshomrim debizman azeh afilu lo nichnasa bechodesh hatishi, rak yom echad melvad, rak yom echad melvad yom shenasar bevav. As long as she has begun the 9th month, okay, 1 day into the 9th month, besides the day which she got pregnant, havevlad kayama. That child is considered bar kayama. You don't need what the Mechaber said: tisha chadashim gemurim, complete 9 months. Even though the Gemara says that one who gives birth in a 9 month baby does not give birth to partially in the 9th month, many have wondered about it. The senses, what we perceive, contradicts this. This is actually, I knew this lie, I never realized the Ramah uses this expression. It's more famously known from the Gra's comment. When the Gra came and basically overturned hundreds of years of practice of Shkia and Seis HaKochavim, because he, Rabbeinu Tam Shita, when he said, Hachush Machesh, you look at it, it's just wrong. You see Gimel Kochavim long before 72 minutes before. That was his expression, Hachush Machesh. The Ramah says, everybody says, knows this is not true. Everybody knows it's not true. You have to say that the realia has changed. He quotes, by the way, a Beis Yosef in the name of the Tashbetz. I cannot find this in the Beis Yosef on the Siman. And nobody comments whether or not this is a mistaken citation, and I've searched the Tashbetz as well, I think, and I couldn't find this either, this express idea, Nishtana Inyan. But the Ramah here introduces this idea that Nishtana Inyan, it's usually quoted as Nishtanu Atfayim, nature has changed. And therefore the Ramah says, if the nature has changed, it's not that the halacha has changed. The halacha is, you have to, midrabanan, you have to know that the child is a bar kayama. The Mechaber was working with the Gemara's Metzias and said that you need 9 full months. The Ramah says, today, you actually don't need 9 full months to determine the child's a bar kayama. What is changing is not the halacha, but what is changing is the science. But the halacha is identical. One can sort of talk about sort of expanding this concept to a couple of other areas. I'll give one example, which might be an example of this, so it might fit in the last category. If you leave liquids uncovered overnight, okay, mayim gluyim, we've seen this already, we've discussed this. So if you leave giloy, the Gemara spends a fair amount of time on, we spent a fair amount of time on it, the Mishnayos and Trumos, we did the sugyas in our perek, the Rambam quotes these, the Rambam, right, Mr. Aristotle and Plato quotes the sugyo. He never quotes meat and fish. That's a throwaway line in the Gemara. But he quotes all the dinim of gila. The Rambam quotes Keseder. Right, and yet we don't observe gila anymore. Even the Mechaber knows that already. Why not? So the Bali Atosa says, they say because nechashim are not metsuyim beinenim. So then there's a case I might argue that this is, that's an equivalent of nishtanu hatvayim. The science has changed, and therefore the halacha still applies. The halacha may be that you're not allowed to do dangerous things. You're not allowed to drink liquids that are dangerous. However, that's only true if they're dangerous. If they are no longer dangerous, because we don't have these snakes that are leaving their venom in the liquid, so then we are not bound to observe it. If one is to adopt that approach, then presumably the same thing should hold true with meat and fish as well. My wife puts out a salad plate for those who want to have their fish on a separate thing than their meat. I wasn't eating the fish, so it didn't matter, but I personally am not makbid. I don't go out of my way dafka to mix the meat and the fish, but people have gone crazy about this. Svardim don't even have milk and fish together, because there's actually an errant text in the Beis Yosef or the Shulchan Aruch or something like that. So many Sfarim don't even have chalav and dagim. Not just basar and dagim, but chalav and dagim. On the one hand. On the other hand, there's a tshuva, I forget where it's quoted in the Chasan Sofer, of the Chasan Sofer, it's quoted in the Pischei Tshuva, somewhere in Yeridea, where people were making a fuss about this, and the Chasan Sofer already said, he doesn't say it's mutter, meat and fish together, mutter, but he said, it's not even clear that we have issues with our fish, that maybe there were different kinds of fish, and therefore, it's like, certainly, there's no reason to go be looking to be machmir and extending chumras on this particular issue. So What's that?
But it's still the broadly accepted people do things.
So I will tell you, by the way, that whether or not one should observe it may depend on why you think it might not be applicable. Whether it's going to fall in the last category or it's going to fall in the category of science. I believe that things that are scientifically disproven or no longer exist scientifically are not an issue. But if you argue for the last category at work here, then you might reach a different conclusion. So I in principle will eat meat and fish together. In reality, it doesn't usually happen, but I would not hesitate, you know, if someone did that. Yeah.
What is the reason for not eating
meat and fish? The Gemara says in Sachem, at the end of a very important Yoredeah sugya, having nothing to do with, this has nothing to do with Yoredeah, there's a sugya about Recha Milsahi, which relates to ovens and the status of ovens when you have stuff that you're cooking and the smell. What status does that smell have? If you cook meat and milk in the same oven together and so on. So at the end of the Gemara says that that meat and fish is a problem because it's kashal davar acher, and davar acher is tzaras. Which is, I don't know if it was leprosy or exactly what it was, but the bottom line is the Gemara assumed it was unhealthy. You know, somewhat unhealthy, maybe a little bit dangerous, and that's all. The Gemara said. Meat and they don't talk about it. They talk about cooking them in the same oven together, just the reyach of the two blending, getting one getting into the other. Ironically, by the way, we paskin b'dieved in a large enough oven. If you cook milk and meat at the same time in an oven, if it's larger than a certain size, it's vented, you can eat both of them. L'chatchila, you're not allowed to cook them at the same time. So milk and meat would not become aser, but milk, meat, and fish, that's a sakana. And we say chamira sakanta meisura. We'll more machmer on that. So, right. Anyway.
So cream cheese and lox are out.
For Sephardim. The Sephardim don't eat. Cream cheese and lox and on a bagel is the quintessential Ashkenazi Jewish food. But many Sephardim won't eat it.
And now we know why.
Now you know why.
But I feel like there's a lot of other things that are disproven and we still do it because it's minhag. Like second day Yom Tov. I mean, we know first day.
No, there's no scientific error there. And the Gemara already addresses that question, right? That's not. We don't keep the second day of Yom Tov because we don't know when Yom Tov is. We keep the second day of Yom Tov because they asked the Shaila, B'nei Chutz La'aretz, at a certain time they knew, and they sent the Shaila, and then they were told, Hizaru ben minagav aseichem yideichem. In other words, it's not that they didn't know when the day was, they did. And nonetheless, they were told to keep it. You know, the reason, here's what it says, the Shema Yaseh or Dabal Kukula, maybe things will revert. Right? So we would say they're not likely to revert anymore. But that's not a question of scientific error. Go ahead. Ask the other ones because I think.
That's the one.
That's right. So, but there's no scientific. There's no error there, right? We're just.
What? Shami says onsha the galuta.
Okay. All right, but that's not what the Bavli says. So.
But the Rosh Hashanah says that, and that makes more sense than anything else.
We should all make aliyah. Okay. Yeah.
But I mean, at a certain point, there was a doubt, which is why they had taken the yontif in the first place. So even if it was in the times of Gemara where they finally realized, oh, we know exactly when the day is, they still had this problem just back then.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
I'm trying.
What's the question?
Meaning, we said.
Right, is that a question or a statement?
No, it's sort of a rebuttal of what your point was.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand what the. That's okay, what's the.
Okay, because you said that we just. The reason we keep doing meat and fish was for Minhag, and then my mom said. Well, you know, we still do a lot. Her point was, we shouldn't, you know, just not do it because it's not relevant anymore. Just like second day Yom Tov, we still do it because, you know, minhag. And then you said, yeah, but they knew it back then.
No, what I'm saying is that, my response is that there's no error involved. I'm saying by meat. And when it comes to meat and fish, the two possibilities, either nishtanu atvan, that our fish are different and there's no sakana, or they were wrong in the first place. Right? That's different than Yom Tov Sheni, where there's no question of error, there's no change in Yom Tov Sheni from the time of the Gemara. Even in the time of the Gemara, at some point above all, they knew when Yom Tov was, and still they were told to keep it. So that is nothing to do, that's not like saying, nothing has changed.
They were told to keep it because of minhag.
Correct. Minhag was separate, so that's the same.
That logic apply to meat and fish too, then. Meaning, if they were told to keep it because of minhag,
So the point is I prefer the error argument, but it doesn't really matter. Nothing has changed from the time of the Gemara. In other words, we don't. According to what you're saying, everything should be observed, even if everything is wrong in it. But that's clearly not what's going on, right? There are places that we depart from following the practice that was. Right, that's clear. So the question is on what criteria? So my argument when it comes to Mayim Galuyim, one of the possibilities is that either the Metzius has changed. In other words, they lived in a society where snakes were spitting their venom into liquid. We don't. Or they were wrong. The snakes never spit their venom into liquid. And the people who died from drinking Mayim Galuyim is just because they happened to have a heart attack right after they drank the water, whatever it was. Right? And that's the way these things get started. Right? You know, correlation does not always mean causation. So my point is that when it comes to meat and fish also, probably it never was dangerous, right? But even if you want to argue maybe it once was dangerous, maybe our fish is different. So there is a fundamental change in the Metzius. So therefore, I'd say any comes to any scientific situation, most cases they were wrong about the science. You know, they misinterpreted something. But even if you want to say that the science has changed, nishtanu inyan, so then the halacha changes accordingly. But the Yom Tov Sheni is not something, anything was nishtana. The only thing that's nishtana, but it's not directly pertinent, is that we don't think the world's going back to the way it once was. Which is just saying we think that the reason for being gozer, of Shema Yasser or Davar L'Kukulo, is not relevant anymore, but that's true. But there are a lot of gzeres. That falls into the general category. What happens when the reason for gzera doesn't apply anymore? But it's not arguing that the gzera itself was errant, or that something has really changed. Yeah.
But the situation never actually changes. It's only our perception of the situation that changes. Meaning...
So then the argument is outright error. In other words, if you don't think it's listen, I also think women it never was the case that women always gave birth only to full 9 months. The idea that Yoledes Letusha and Yoledes Nekutan, I'm sure was never true. I'll let if any OBGYNs want to weigh in on that, but I'm fairly certain that it never has been the case that women always went full 9 months. I'm sure that's just never the case. So if
probably
you want,
probably actually happened less than does that.
What's that?
Probably happened.
Okay, I won't venture to guess anything, but I could be.
Now they put you at bed rest, but they do all kinds of things.
So I would just say that for the most part, it really is. I mean, it's our perception that they were wrong. But when it comes to an error, which almost by definition means science of some kind, then we're not bound by their interpretation. Now, the halacha remains the same, but if it's based upon a scientific error, so then it's not relevant to us.
But have they not asked the Shiloh about Yom Tov Sheni, right? Let's say, then they could have been one day of Yom Tov Sheni.
It's possible, yes.
Because it was Pesach, when they asked it specifically.
Yes. That's the rule. You know, someone said there's an ambiguity in yesterday's Haftorah about Manoach. Manoach was a buffoon, but it wasn't enough to trust his wife when she told him what the Malach said, so he goes back. So he says, the Malach says to Manoach, Mikol Asher Amarti al Ha'isha, Tishamer, which is ambiguous, because Tishamer can be third feminine singular, she should be careful, or it can be you should be careful. So the moral of the story is that when you ask too many questions, you get more chumra. So now Manoach had to keep the restrictions also. Yeah, good.
Haven't we only applied the idea of nishtana inyan to scientific change, but not to sociological or societal change? If we're willing to say that, we say that the realities have changed in regards to a scientific matter, but we're not going to say that the realities.
So I think by the way that there are cases.
There are societal changes. We talk about women covering their hair. We just spoke about that.
Let's wait on that. Let me answer the question more directly, which is there are places I think where we will argue that sociological change has an impact. Firstly, I would say two things. Firstly, sociological change is real change. Scientific change, for the most part, is not really change. It's an error. But
it's an error.
Okay. Where sociological change is not an error, it is actually change in many cases. But I will say there are areas in halacha. In other words, I would say the following. The rule we're operating with is that afal pisha bat la tam la bat la gzera. One of the reasons why the reasons for things disappears are because societal change. Take, for example, the gzeras refuah on Shabbos. Right? Today, although spite medicines are ground up, they're no longer ground up in your house. They're ground up at the companies, right? And therefore, you get it in your bottle, and a pill in your bottle. There's no reason that you're taking an aspirin for a minor headache on Shabbos that you're going to come to grind things. But the Xeris Refua might still apply, right? That's saying that the way we do things, that's a societal change. But even though the reason is no longer relevant, the Xeris still applies. But the reason was once true. But I'll tell you where we do take into account theoretically.
But why would we not take that into account? Ishtana Hedian.
No, the Rama would say the following. Here, what we're talking about is determining whether the child is a Vlad Shel Kayama. Now, the Chazal said that you need a full, or they used to say you need a full 9 months to know that, because otherwise there's a degree of uncertainty. He would say that today, because the realia has changed, we achieve the same degree of certainty that they had even without 9 full months. If you talk about something that you might even argue when it comes to, let's say, Mayim Galuyim. Let me make the following argument. Mayim Galuyim is presumably not an Issa D'Oraisa. It's some type of Xerah. If it were an Issa D'Oraisa, it would be easy to solve. It wouldn't be a problem. It's just not, if it's ironically, if it's Midoraisa, it's easier. Because the reality has changed. There's no Xerah here, and for sure you're changing. But let's say that Giloy is not that. It's not enough of a Sakana. It's not enough of a Sakana that it should be Aser Midoraisa. But Midrabanan, they said even if it's 1% Sakana, it should be Aser. So now Chazal said, by the way, you want to know, Mayim Galuyim is a 1% Sakana. It's not Aser Midoraisa, but it's Aser Midrabanan. Today we say, well, it's even less than a 1% Sakana because we don't have snakes Mitsuyim. So basically we would say that we are actually following the Gzera. The Mitzias of the Gzera has changed. The reality of the Gzera has changed. Whereas it's not the reason, in other words, the Gzera remains intact. The Gzera says that the Midrash Torah, this is a threshold of Sakana. Midrabanan, the threshold is lower. The Rabbanan said you have to be Makbid even for the lower threshold. But that's not the same thing as saying, you know, the reason for the Gzera no longer applies, so therefore the Gzera is done away with. Right? You want to do away with the Gzera on Refuah because our perception, the way we do things has changed. Here, I'm not doing away with the Gzera on Mayim Galuyim. I'm arguing that Mayim Galuyim doesn't fall under the Gzera anymore. Now, one place where I think that sociological change does have an impact, but this is probably by Dinam D'Oraisa, this is very controversial, but when it comes to the question of Chazakos, right, there's a very famous statement of the Rav. I suspect the statement was heavily polemical, but it had to do with the Chazaka, which has a major impact in terms of Kiddushei Taos, of Tav L'Meisav Tandum L'Meisav Armala, which means that a woman wants to be married, we mentioned this, I think, in the last couple of weeks, at all costs. Right. In other words, and therefore, there cannot be any grounds for Kiddushei Taos because she would have wanted to be married to him anyway, because it's better to be married than to be single. Or Chazakos of Milsa David Lagli Lo Mishakre Inshe. Right, that's something that is likely to be found out. A person's not going to lie about. Right, one can argue that based upon societal norms, that these things actually can change. The Rav got very—he was battling over. He was right on the halacha. I'm not sure many would agree with the reason why he's right on the halacha. He was battling over the question of this Kiddushei Taos question with Rabbi Rachman. And so the Rav said these chazakos are unchanging. They're a part of the bria. So I think one could really argue that no, the chazakos do change. It's clear today that women would have a It is true. People might not like this, but 150 or 200 years ago, a woman would more likely have accepted much less and tolerated much more because the alternative being single and perhaps being unable to support oneself and survive was outweighed. So it would rather to be in a really crummy marriage than to be in a situation where you're going to starve to death. It's hard for us to imagine that, but that is the reality of the world of 150 years ago. Many would say, I know Rav Aaron did not necessarily agree with the Rav's presentation, that Tav L'Meisav Tandu doesn't carry the same force as it would today. So there's a case where social change certainly has very much an impact upon halacha, although arguably that's a din d'oraisa. In other words, there the d'oraisa din is simply dependent upon is based upon determining what are human modes of behavior. But I think if you're talking about Gzeira D'Rabbanan, it's more complicated. The fact that our circumstances have changed does not automatically mean that you want to do away with the Gzeira. Somebody lost. As opposed to saying that the Gzeira applies, but the Metzius is different, so you have to apply it in a different way.
I'm not understanding the distinction between the water that is left open and the medicine, because can you just say that the true Gzera by the medicine is that you can't do something on Shabbos that might lead you to do Malacha, and therefore this situation just doesn't fall under that Gzera anymore because it's not going to lead you to do Malacha?
One of them is looking at sort of what I call an established fact. You know, this is dangerous, don't drink it. So our argument is it's not dangerous. Even if it was dangerous, it's not dangerous in our particular context, right? But the other one, in the other case, grinding the spices is usher. How likely, just as in a given circumstances, in other words, one person might be more likely to grind than the other, but we say it's a low plug. So by the same token, we say that even if your particular societal context, you are not likely to grind something up. It's not impossible, but it's highly unlikely you're going to do so. So nonetheless, the Xera still applies. And you're talking about a situation where because I am unlikely to come to do X, you know, they prohibit A because you might come to do B. I'm not likely to come to do B. In fact, the truth is nobody today in our community is likely to come to do B. But you know, 150, 200, when they made the Xera, there were a subset of people that also weren't likely to do B. But nonetheless, they made the Xera in everybody. So in that sense, the Xera still applies to everybody. But here the argument would be is that this fish is dangerous for nobody. Maybe it was never dangerous for anybody, right? The Mayan Galuyim is dangerous for nobody. And they were only gozer on a certain type of Mayim, a certain type of uncovered liquids, not other uncovered liquids. Why don't you, I feel like, I this makes me good, I feel like, well, I'm up in YU giving shear now. Tag teaming against me. So let me move on. I agree with one thing. The lines are sometimes not always clear. I think that the ultimate dominant factor is going to be when we get to the last one, which I'm going to try to get to. But let me first do the one in between, okay? I quote, there is a halacha, okay, so Adrian, we're violating this now, you're not allowed to teach women Torah, and certainly Torah Shebaal Peh, right? The Rama made a distinction between Torah Shebaal Sav and Torah Shebaal Peh, okay? Watch it, Ben. So as it's well known, this is no longer the practice in most of Klal Yisrael. I mean, in most of observant Klal Yisrael, women at least study Torah Shebaal Sav. In our community, it's pretty common for women to study Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, why is that so? So you can try to give all sorts of reasons why. Some want to say that the Mishnah is not formulated as an Isser, it's formulated as advice. It's a funny formulation. Rabbi Lezer doesn't say that it's also to teach your daughter Torah. He says, Ben Azai says it's a good idea, and Rabbi Lezer says, Kala malamed isbito Torah ki ilu malamda tiflis. He's teaching our frivolity. That's not as bad as I believe Rabbi Lezer in the Yushalmi. Lezer in the Yushalmi says, brace yourself. Mutav sheyisofru divrei Torah v'ayimasru l'nashim. Better the words of Torah be burned than be handed over to women. Okay, Rabbi Elazar had a certain worldview. Ben Azai did not agree. Okay, we do not subscribe to that worldview. We just don't. And I think it's a better world for that. But Rabbi Elazar, I don't judge Rabbi Elazar. He lived in a different world. So the Shulchan Aruch says it's aser. But the Mechavetz Chaim was already asked about the Beis Yaakov movement. And the Chafetz Chaim basically said that if you don't do this, it's going to be a disaster. He said that people used to get their Torah from the home. They used to have the Mimetic tradition, and that worked. But it doesn't work anymore. And women, young women were being educated in the gymnasia, and if you didn't give them a Torah education, it was going to be a Churban of Klal Yisrael. Now, if you assume that the Chafetz Chaim was basically saying, violate the Shulchan Aruch, which I think is the simple reading, the grounds on which he did so, obviously this is sort of supra halachic. This is not under the normal category. This is what we call Eislaso Slashem Heferu Torah Secha. This is Aser, but we have to abrogate the Iser following not the normal rules, because otherwise we won't survive. In the very same way that the Gemara suggests that the practice of writing down Torah Shebaal Peh, which, it's funny, the Rambam never even quotes it. He hasn't quoted the Minyan Mitzvah, he hasn't quoted anywhere in the Mishnah Torah a prohibition of writing down Torah Shebaal Peh. I don't know what he thought about it, because it's odd that he doesn't quote it all, but he doesn't. But if you was to take the Gemara literally at face value, there seems to be even kind of an Isser Torah of writing down. It's a Darshan Apostle. Ki al pi advaram ha'ela, ksav l'chos advaram ha'elo, dvaram ha'elo atar shari l'kosvam, v'yatar rashai l'chtov Torah Shebaal Peh. You're not allowed to write Torah Shebaal Peh. But the Gemara says, Eis lasos l'ashem eferu Torah secha, because Torah was going to be forgotten. Which means, basically, we abrogate, if that's really a Torah law, in order to preserve Torah. And in the same way the Chafetz Chaim might have been abrogating a din d'rabbanan. If that's the case, and the Ravs, you know, there are those who will claim, this is certainly not Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's view in principle, but some will claim, and it might be true, that the Ravs' view was the same position, which is if you don't teach women, giving them a sophisticated Torah education, and a sophisticated Torah education means Torah Shebaal Peh, you're asking for, it's a recipe for disaster, and so on. And that's why Rav Aaron's, I would just say the following, even if you assume that that's the mechanism on which it was permitted, and this is the way I like to say it, it's, you know, it's like dynamite in the shack, and only a few people have the keys to the shack, right? It has to be someone, it's the people who have done these kinds of things and have been accepted are people who are Gedolei Yisrael, whose mere saying we have to do this was enough to tell the people would accept that you have to do this, right? It wasn't just anybody, not just anybody with smicha, you know, from YU can get up and say, okay, well, it's Eis Lasos L'Hashem Efer Torah Secha, let's do away with this particular Isser. So if you understand the Chafetz Chaim this way, so basically there's a, you know, we had a category of so far of applying the Gemara, the halacha, just to a different circumstance. There is an ishtane ha'inyan that the Rama raises, and then there is an unusual case where we actually do abrogate Torah law, certainly drabanans, you know, that are found in the Gemara, because eis lasos l'Hashem efer Torah secha, the exigencies of the time demand such a radical course of action. But obviously, this has to be an extreme limited. It is an extreme measure, and it has to be used in very limited circumstances. Now, the last category, which is the one that has always, that has been, you know, the windmill that I've been chasing for a very long time, is the situations where the halacha does really appear to change, going back to our conversation before that I was trying to avoid, which is when the reason for the gezeirah no longer applies, the gezeirah doesn't apply. Meaning it once was relevant, but it's no longer relevant. And I take as Exhibit A the last two sources, and I mentioned this already at different times in Shir. Amalei Rava Bar Charchana Labaye Tanan. It says in the Mishnah, Ein Metapchin, Ve'ein Mesapkim, Ve'ein Merakdin. You can't clap and sing, you can't clap and dance and so on. And bang, V'haidana. It's a Mishnah. Why are you not allowed to do it, by the way, according to the Gemara? The Mishnah doesn't say why. The Gemara says, Shema Yisakein Klei Shir. Okay? You're banging around, and you know what? Get my drums out. Oh, the drum is broken. Let me fix it. The string on the guitar is broken. Let me fix it. That's what the Gemara says. Shema Yisakein Klei Shir.
On
Shabbos and Yom Tov. Yes. Okay. Yes. No. Some would say you can't play musical instruments all year round, but that's because the Churban Beis Hamikdash. But that's not the minhag in much of our community. He says, Vahidana. But Rabba Bar Rav Chanan says to Abaye, but Vahidana today, meaning fourth generation Amoraic Babylonia, the Kochazina da Avdan Hachi, people do it. We don't say a word to them. Amar le, Hanach lahem li Yisrael, mutav sheyu shogigin v'yu mizidin. It is aser, but better not to say anything to them because they're not going to listen to you. So better they violate the iser b'shogig than they violate the iser b'mezid. Okay, and that is a very important topic in its own right. That's not the part that interests me. The Shulchan Aruch comes along and says, "V'ha," the Rama says on the last source, after the Mechaber says it's aser to clap and dance and bang on Shabbos and Yom Tov, the Rama says, "V'had the Misapkim Merakdin Hoydana V'lo Mechinam Behu." We don't protest Mishum the Mutav Shiyu Shogegin V'chulei. V'yesh Omrim the Bezman Azeh Hakol Shari the Einanu Bekiyam Basias Klei Shir. You know, this is Tosos they're quoting now. Tosos, because this is so classic Tosos. Tosos on that Gemara says, "Yeah, but us, we do it." So Tosos wasn't content with the answer of Mutav because we are Kehila Kedosha of Ashkenaz. It's not because we have our yanim. There must be a reason it's mutter. So Tosus said, we're not expert in fixing clay shear, so that's why the gzeira doesn't apply to us. So Tosus says, so the Rambam is just quoting Tosus here, that the zman hazeh kol shari de einanu bekiyam basias clay shear, veleka lemigzar shem yisaka and clay shear, de milsa de l'shiachu, the efshar sh'alzeh nagu l'hakel bakol. That's why they are mekel. That is Tosus. Now, I'd like to say the following. So it sounds like, now of course everybody, all the Acharonim scratch their heads over this. So, the reason for the Gzera doesn't apply, the Din doesn't apply. That's great. Because I have a lot of things on my list. So I have the following question for you. Is it mutter to play musical instruments on Shabbos or Yom Tov? No. Nobody says, leave aside today, no Beis HaMikdash. No, it's aser. Orthodox Jews do not play musical instruments. Or observant Orthodox Jews not play musical instruments on Shabbos. If you want to know how much of a fight the organ provoked, you know, there are certain things that, even if you could devise a way of being mutter, are usher forever. I said that like the Yudches Davar, the umbrella on Shabbos, the organ in a shul. You know, you probably have any instrument in the shul. A guitar maybe for Kabbalah Shabbos before it's Shabbos might be mutter. An organ will be usher forever, right? Because how much blood was spilled over this in the 18th and 19th centuries? The orgel, as Rav Tzvi Hoffman cites the word, is absolutely awesome. So we don't play musical instruments. I don't understand why not. We're not b'kiyam b'tekun klei shir. The reason for not playing a musical instrument on Shabbos and Yom Tov is the very same reason for not dancing. Now, in classic Achronish fashion, the some Achronim start to declare, so they say no, but maybe one is close, so they start to explain. So I want to make the following observation. It's not that the Balei HaTosos woke up. It's clear that it's not the case. They didn't wake up one drab, you know, it's Simchas Torah already, is the fall, it's Northern Europe, it's a short day, it's cold, and the things are pretty dull around here. Why don't we dance and liven these up? That's not what happened. The Balei Tosfos confronted a reality that existed already, that Jews in their community did this on Shabbos and Yom Kippur. And the Balei Tosfos, their Jews did not play musical instruments. And you might argue common sense dictates the distinction, that playing a musical instrument, if you play a guitar, it's very possible you're going to forget a Shabbos because if the string breaks, then you're going to retie. Makes sense. It's not likely, you know, we're clapping, we're so into it, that, and he goes and he gets his guitar, starts, and the string breaks and he fixes, right? That's already another step. And his Kal Yisrael might have an intuitive sense. But the bottom line is the Balei Tosfos did not come along, and they were not matir egzera. Rather, they came along and they saw what was being done, and they put their stamp of approval on it. Now, what's going on here? So Rav Shechter likes to quote a Mishkanos Yaakov. I finally did find this Mishkanos Yaakov, but it's not clear to me what the Mishkanos Yaakov really says, who has the following idea. So I think this has to be, I think it's Rav Shechter's sort of idea, which is that we have a principle that called the Tikkun Rabbanon Ke'en Daraisa Tikkun, that rabbinic zeros are modeled upon Torah Dinim. That's Gemara has that idea. So we have by Torah Dinim an idea of a machlokus whether Darshin on time of the Krah. If you know the reason for a particular prohibition and the reason doesn't apply, are you allowed to violate it? Because it doesn't really apply to you in your circumstance. So it's the way the Gemara presents it, it's a machlokas hatanai. It is assumed, but it's not clear how we know this, that we paskin lo darshin in time of the Krah, that you cannot say, even if you know the reason for the prohibition, you can't say, since it doesn't apply to me, I can do this. However, the Gemara says, if you believe lo darshin in time of the Krah, if the Torah explicitly spells out the reason, then the reason regulates the application of the mitzvah. For example, and it's not, I don't think people realize this, it is common practice in our community, not me personally, but people will cross-dress on Purim. Right? The same question, by the way, will come up in a high school play. If you want, you know, a guy, an MTA, an all-male school, can someone dress up as a woman? There's always a big fight with some of the rabbin. The answer is a pasha, of course it's mutar. Why? Because if you look at the Sifrei, and Rashi quotes it, the prohibition on cross-dressing is ki tovas Hashem kol osei eile, and Rashi writes, the Sifrei writes, lo asar makasav ela derech toeva. It's only when it's done for the purposes of arayis, for men mingling with women, women with men, then it's prohibited. But on Purim, it's done for bidichusa. In a play, in a school, it's being done for theater, not because someone's actually, intent is for arayos, and therefore, it's not prohibited. Why? Because the Torah spells out the reason. So Rav Shechter wants to say that the same thing works by Gzeiras the Rabbanon, that if the reason is part of the Gzeira, then like the Torah spelling out the reason, then if the reason doesn't apply, the Gzeira doesn't apply. If, however, the reason is not part of the Gzeira, then even though the reason doesn't apply, the Gzeira still applies.
Doesn't every Gzeira have a reason?
Thank you. So this is the question the first time I heard it. It's like, what? How do you know? How do you know when the reason, what was it, was in the proclamation that the squire read, you know, this gazer and this is the reason, and sometimes they gave the reason, sometimes they didn't. You know, we just saw the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, about to see it, that they didn't publicize a gzera for the first 12 months, because they didn't want people to be mafakpik in the gzera. They didn't publicize the reason for the gzera. How do we know, looking at the Gemara, when the reason was part of the not? But I'm going to throw more fuel on the fire. I'm going to prove that it's wrong. Because I'm sure there are other examples, but I know of only off of one hand, one gezera, that the Gemara does not give the reason for at all. And that is the prohibition of getting on a boat 3 days before Shabbos. Ema fligin besvina pachos migimah yom kodem haShabbos. Why are you not allowed to get on a boat 3 days before Shabbos? Gemara doesn't say. There are, I believe, seven different interpretations of the Rishonim how to explain that Gemara, ranging from the Rashbam's position that it's only Beis Shammai who holds that way, to the other six reasons, which all find some reason for it. Most of you know the famous one, that you'll be seasick, and it takes you 3 days to adjust, and so on and so forth. There are lots of important shittos that come out of this. You know, it's fascinating to get in its own right, but this is the part that interests me. Two shittos in particular. Number one is Shitas Rabbeinu Tam. The Gemara says that it's mutter, you'd get on a boat on Friday if it's Lidvar Mitzvah. Now, Rabbeinu Tam says, what's the definition of Dvar Mitzvah? Anything but a pleasure cruise. Business. Isek, Prakmacha is a Dvar Mitzvah. Now, how many Jews in medieval Ashkenaz or Sfarad were traveling on boats for pleasure? It was dangerous to go on the seas. Rabbeinu Tam is basically saying, he's defending the communal practice. Jewish merchants were doing it. The answer is, Mekach u'memkar is called the Dvar Mitzvah. But that's not striking. That's Rabbeinu Tam. And so, by the way, it's classic Rabbeinu Tam. He doesn't say our circumstances are different. He rereads the Gemara to explain why there's really no conflict. Not
selling to a non-Jew.
What's that?
Selling to a non-Jew.
Right. No, it's classic Rabbeinu Tam's all the Balei Tosfos justify common practice, but Rabbeinu Tam has a unique MO, right? Not of saying our circumstances are different, economy is different. He says you're misreading the Gemara. Dvar mitzvah means even business. More striking is someone of early Chachmei Sarah doing this, because this was not the methodology of the Rambam and the Rif in that era. Rabbeinu Hananel is quoted by the Rif as saying that it only is because there's a Tum Shabbos problem, and there's no Tum above 10 Tfachim, which means this only applies in the shallowest of rivers or lakes. But on an ocean, which is more than 10 Tfachim deep, and the ground is where you measure Tum on, you're above 10 Tfachim, there's no din of Tum. So it's clear to me Rabbeinu Hananel is coming along to defend the communal practice. So let me get this straight. So even in Svarad, they're doing this. They're defending the communal practice. So let me get this straight. We have a gzeira of which there's no reason in the Gemara. There are seven different interpretations. And you're going to tell me that that's mutter whenever the reason doesn't apply, because everybody's assuming in that case that if they're all, you know, Rabbeinu Tam and Rabbeinu Hananel are assuming that if the reason doesn't apply, the gzeira doesn't apply. Right? That's a fact. And you're going to tell me because the reason was part of the gzeira. The reason was part of the gzeira. The Gemara doesn't even tell us what the reason is, and we don't even know what it is. Cannot be. Methodologically, you're correct. That was always been my objection. How do you know? And this particular piece of data is like, okay. So what is the answer to the question? The answer to the question is, Dever Shebeminyat Sarach Minyan Achal Artira. What makes the Talmud Bavli binding? Klal Yisrael accepted it. When Klal Yisrael decides that a particular gzeira, and they don't usually sit down to decide rationally, you know, in a thoughtful process. When it happens that Klal Yisrael has decided that a gzeira no longer applies, then you have a minyan achar latira. Reb Moshe, I said this for many years, this was my working theory, I stand by it. Reb Moshe has a tshuva somewhere, I didn't put it here. Reb Moshe writes in a tshuva somewhere, essentially accepting the same principle, but he says the following. He says, you know that a gzeira she'enat rovat tziri cholon lamabo is not really binding. Now, the way it's presented in the Gemara is that in goes to Xera la Tzibur, el in keyachol lamadbo. You don't make Xera unless you think they're going to be able to observe it. So Reb Moshe says that in our case, once the community is no longer observing it, it's like Xera in robat Tzibur, el in lamadbo, and therefore, Xera really shouldn't be binding. Now, the only problem is that we saw in some of our discussions, you still may require something to be matirit, right? The Ritva, for example, accepted by Pasakum, the mistaken interpretation of what Rabbi Yehuda Nasi did. People made an error. They thought Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was Matir Paspaltar. He really wasn't. But that was enough to be Matir Paspaltar. Right? That's the kol dehu once the community is doing it. So Reb Moshe says, Mistama, if the Sanhedrin were around today, they would be Matir. They would say, of course you should be Matir because the community is not doing it. That's very much, he doesn't quote this Ritva. I don't know if Reb Moshe saw the Ritva. It's very much the same idea that once the community is no longer doing it, it's like Xera Shein Atzibi Chol Lamabo. And I'll tell you today, you know what the Minyan Achal Atiro is? When a posse come, like the Aruch HaShulchan comes along and writes that we don't do it because the reason doesn't apply, that's the Minyan Achal Atiro. When it gets its sort of formal acceptance at some point, that's when it really becomes totally officially mutter. But what really is happening is that, again, how you define the observant community is a separate question, but when the... What?
That's a very big question.
It is a big question. It's not... There's no scientific answer to that question. It's often is the victor's right history.
That's right.
I understand that, right? It used to work better when communities were isolated from one another. So one community would develop the practice, and eventually it might have been standard practice, but that was a minute. Like, Sfardim did not always dance and clap, right? But it was enough that in Ashkenaz, so that was the practice. That was a shita. Today, because the world is all one world, like there's no separation and everybody knows what everybody's doing, it becomes more complicated. But at least I brought us up until recent times to explain how things were changing. So that's what I think is going on. The rule is when the community, however you define community, broad enough and no longer observes a particular Xerah Drabbanan, that is your minyan acher lahatira. Dr. Briskin?
I want to go back to women learning Torah. Is it based on this on Rabbi Lesser's opinion?
The Isser is Rabbi Lesser.
Now, there is a minority opinion. Ben Azai says it's permissible. Does it ever happen that the minority opinion then takes over?
I would just argue the following. I've always wondered, you know, why didn't somebody just say that we're following Ben Azai today? So I think the answer is because in legal process, I think this is not true only in halacha, you can't reach back into time and say, okay, you know, we're going to follow the other shita. Now, Ben Azai's position over 2,000 years was basically set aside. So yes, we can say on a certain level, it's true that that we could pass like Ben Azai, but that's not how we got there. Even if Ben Azai hadn't said that, the Chafetz Chaim would still have said what he said. Right? I don't think he was thinking at all. He doesn't mention, you know what, well, let's rely upon the other shita. Because Ben Azai's shita has basically been consigned, for practical purposes, been consigned to the dustbin, you know, of history. The Chafetz Chaim's coming at it from a different angle. So, on an undecided issue, you can pull another shita. But once there's a track record of centuries of practice, that other pathway has been closed. So we come back to Ben Azai's position, you know, that it's a mitzvah, la'adam shilam is bitator, but for a very different reason than Ben Azai, right? Our circumstances dictate even more than his the absolute necessity of doing so. I mean, you can bet, by the way, Ben Azai's time, nobody was teaching the daughter's Torah, almost nobody. Hanina ben Thrajon taught his daughter Torah. His daughter was Beruya. Yeah. All right, last question.
Saying that the community follows halacha, the halacha follows the community as opposed to a community following halacha?
Often, yes.
So then...
Let me formulate in the following fashion. At a certain point, if most of the infirm community does X, you know, they don't do X on Shabbos, at some point you're spitting into the wind trying to stop it. In other words, it means they have accepted a certain position. It might have been a position that wasn't universally accepted yet. It might be one's job as a posek to explain why it's a mutter.
I was saying, if that's what we're saying, where do we draw the line? Like, what can be changed? I mean, obviously, if all clients all decide to do a vote of Zara, we're going to say, okay, you're not allowed to do a vote of Zara.
So one could, the first question, one could distinguish between the Raisas and the Rabbanans. It's not clear that we would ever say that by the Raisa, although, even if it were the Raisa, we might go figure out why it might actually be Mutter. Right? On some level, the formalization of acceptance depends upon when someone, a Rav or a Posek, someone with enough force, looks at the issue and says, yeah, it's Mutter because... Right, so I'm not even saying, because you could have malachos on Shabbos, that's something I might interpret as a malacha, and someone would come along and figure out why there's a shita that says that it's really mutter, that's not a malacha. Right, they could be pulling back a shita that maybe it was a once a rejected shita, or maybe or another way of analyzing things and looking at a different light. So there's no, I don't want to say, I do not take the, I never assume that anything could become mutter, but I think if Klal Yisrael has adopted a practice in many cases, I think there's often a way of being able to find a way to justify it. Now, I do want to introduce one caveat into this, but this is a personal one. I'm not sure that it's true. What?
Like a paris with chickens.
That would be an example, right? But that's... yes, Darkei HaMori, although that may be different by its own right, because Darkei HaMori can, in other words, what was once non-Jewish practice can become Jewish practice. But let me say the following. There's one place I would personally draw the line, but someone might challenge me on this. I think on ethical matters, that's not the case. You know, if most from Jews decide it's mutter to cheat on the taxes, I don't think it's mutter to cheat on the taxes. Now, you can ask me the question, in other words, Choshen Mishpat is an Eir in Halacha. It plays by slightly different rules, because it's not Gzeiros the Rabbanon. Typically, but I think that certain kinds of matters are so core, unchangeable. Now that to me it's inconceivable that anybody would come. I mean, it's not inconceivable because their poskim would write that. Let's put it.
I'm quiet. I know you're
very, very few people. Listen, very few people in the world of which I work, even those who are leaning to the right, looking over the shoulder to the right, would want to be caught dead in public saying that. What they said in private would be a separate issue. There are certain people who write tshuvos that would say that. For the most part, nobody wants to get caught dead saying those things. You know, they might do them. They might tell people privately, but they would not. There are such people. Unfortunately, I know there are such people. But I view that as something that basic ethics and justice issues, which are clear, you know, which are derived from halacha, those are not subject to people deciding to violate them. But you could ask the question, why not? You know, but I think that when it comes to mitzvahs, certainly ben adam lamakom, I think that I don't want to say anything could be subject to change. But poskim, if the change takes root broadly enough, poskim can usually figure out a reason why maybe it should be defended.